Good morning, dear friends. Today is Sunday, September the 25th in the year 2011, and we are in the Ocean of Peace Meditation Hall, Deer Park Monastery, in our day of mindfulness. You agree with me that there is honey in the kingdom of God. And because there is honey, there are bees. But there is also mindfulness. And with mindfulness, we can overcome difficulties, we can handle anything that is difficult. Today's Dhamma talk will be on the theme of right view. Right view. But there are a few questions that will be answered on at the end of the Dhamma talk. I will read some of these questions. How do people apply mindfulness when they are fearful about financial security or the future or when they are out of work? In other words, in times of crisis like this, how can mindfulness help? So many people suffer yet will not even take one step to help themselves, even though they say they want to. They appear a bit lost. To the person who has never heard of mindfulness, what is the one thing you should say, you would say to them? The one first step a first timer can take to bring the start of mindfulness into their life. There are many wars in the world, and more all the time, it seems. When I once asked what we can each do about this, you said, peace in yourself, peace in the world. Okay, could you explain that? People tend to talk of monks and mindfulness in very serious tones, but I know you have a good sense of humor. And you and other monks are happy. How can mindfulness be fun? How can one use it during fun or to have more fun? We have all heard of multitasking, but you talk about unitasking. What is unitasking or monotasking? Could you explain how mindfulness is a practice? So many questions. Our monks and nuns and lay teachers, Dharma teachers, are trying to bring mindfulness, the practice of mindfulness, into society in a non-sectarian form. We know that mindfulness can help many people. The practice of mindfulness can help us release the tension in our body. There's a lot of tension in our body. And even children have a lot of tension in their body. So the mindfulness, the practice of mindfulness can help release the tension in the body and also reduce the pain in the body. And you don't need to be a Buddhist in order to do that. And then the practice of mindfulness can can help us handle a painful feeling. Because the energy of mindfulness can help us recognize the painful feeling and embrace it in order to bring a relief. The practice of mindfulness can help us handle a strong emotion like fear, anger, despair. There's so many young people who do not know how to handle a strong emotion, and they believe that the only way to stop suffering is to go and kill themselves. So you have to offer them the practice. And the practice of mindfulness help us to generate a feeling of joy, to bring in a moment of joy whenever you want it. The practice of mindfulness can help us to generate a feeling of happiness if you want it. The practice of mindfulness can help us restore communication using loving speech and deep listening in order to restore communication and reconcile. So all these things can be practiced in order to reduce the suffering and to create happiness. And this teaching and practice can be taken up by anyone in society, and you don't need to be a Buddhist in order to do so. But the practice of mindfulness also needs some kind of insight, right view, in order to be done correctly. Right view is the kind of insight that helps us to think correctly. It helps us to say things correctly and to do things correctly for not creating suffering and despair for oneself and for other people. So right view is the foundation for right thinking. Right view is the foundation for right speech. And right view is also the foundation for right action. And if we practice mindfulness, we can produce thoughts in the line of right thinking, full of understanding and compassion. We can only create happiness. We will not create the suffering for ourselves and for other people. With the practice of right speech, we can say or write things in the direction of understanding, compassion, non-discrimination, and we can only create happiness and not suffering. And with the practice of right action, our bodily action, our physical action will only protect, save, help, rescue, and that is why the practice of mindfulness based on right view can help heal ourselves and help heal the world. And we can start right away if we have a friend or a community practice supporting us. But right view is something we have to cultivate. If you can listen to a Dhamma talk, you can read a book, you get some ideas about right view, but not right view yet. Right view is something you experience directly and not through concepts. and ideas. It's like eating a fruit called a kiwi. If you have not had experience of eating a kiwi, no matter how I try to describe it to you, you cannot have a direct experience of the taste of kiwi. You may read a book, 300 pages, you may listen to 10 discourse, but still you don't have the direct experience of the taste of kiwi. So right view is like that. Listen to a Dhamma talk, read in a book, you might have some idea that can help you to try and taste right view. And right view, we know that that is the foundation of right thinking, right speech, and right action. Right view is the foundation of the Noble Eightfold Path presented by the Buddha. And one day there is a monk whose name is Katyayana. He came to the Buddha and he asked the question, "Dear teacher, you often use the word, the expression right view. What does it mean exactly? What is right view?" And the Buddha said that people in the world, they are caught by the idea of being and non-being. And because of the fact that they are caught by the notion of being and non-being, they cannot get right view, right understanding of reality, of themselves and of the world. So right view, according to the Buddha, is the kind of insight, the kind of understanding that can transcend the notion of being and non-being, which is something not too easy to understand. When we speak of creation, when we speak of birth, the birth of something, the creation of something, we are already caught in the notion of being and non-being. We believe that from non-being, from the realm of non-being, we can pass into the realm of being. And from the realm of being, we can pass into the realm of non-being. And to be born means from the realm of non-being, you pass into the realm of being. You did not exist. You begin to exist only from the time you are born. So birth means from the realm of non-being, you pass into the realm of being. That's how we think. And that is not right thinking. And to die means from the realm of being, you pass into the realm of non-being. From someone, you suddenly become no one. And to be born means from no one, you suddenly become someone. That's the way we used to think. So if you are caught in the notion of being and non-being, you are caught also in the notion of birth and death. And when you observe reality as it is, you can touch the truth that reality is free from the notion of birth and death, being and non-being. Suppose we talk about a cloud. Can we speak about the birth of a cloud? According to our thinking, to be born means from nothing you become something. But looking deeply, we know that the cloud has not come from nothing. The cloud has come from something. Like the water in the ocean, the heat generated by the sun, many things like that. So it is very clear that our cloud has not come from the realm of non-being. The moment when you see the cloud, that is a new manifestation. Before that, it was there in another form. So the true nature of the cloud is the nature of no birth. The cloud has never been born. It has not come from the realm of non-being into the realm of being. And when you look up into the sky, you do not see your beloved cloud anymore. You think your cloud has died. Your cloud has passed from the realm of being into non-being, and you cry. But the fact is that your cloud has not died. It is impossible for a cloud to die. A cloud can become rain or snow or ice, but it is impossible for a cloud to become nothing. So the true nature of the cloud is the nature of no birth and no death. And the cloud hasn't come from the realm of non-being, and the cloud will not go to the realm of non-being. And the same thing is true with everything else, including ourselves, including our grandfather, our great-grandmother. They have not passed into the realm of non-being. And if we look deeply, we can still see them around very close in a new manifestation. I'm pouring my cloud. Into the glass mindfully. And we know that yesterday it was a cloud. And if you are a practitioner of mindfulness, you can see the cloud in a tea. Your cloud has not died. It has just become the tea. The tea is the continuation of the cloud. And when you drink your tea mindfully, you know that you are drinking your cloud. You already have a lot of cloud inside. This is only another cloud coming in order to nourish you. You are like a cloud. Your nature is the nature of no birth and no death. Being afraid of dying is not right thinking, because nothing can pass from being into non-being. Nothing can pass from non-being into being. When we do walking meditation from down there up here, we may see the soil, the dirt road. The topsoil. When you look at the topsoil, the dirt, deeply with mindfulness and concentration, you can see it is the continuation of something else. The oak leaves, the leaves of other trees. There are many thousand years. And the soil that you see there is a continuation of the dead leaves, the fallen leaf. And if you have not seen the leaves in the soil, you have not seen the soil. If you cannot see the cloud in the tea, you have not seen really the tea. And mindfulness, concentration, bring insight. When you look at the tea, you see the cloud. In the Diamond Sutra, which is a very famous sutra in the Zen tradition, you learn that there are four notions that you have to remove if you don't want to suffer. Because these four notions are the ground of discrimination and fear and hate. And first is the notion of self. You distinguish between self and non-self. You separate reality into two parts. One part is yourself, or himself, or herself. And the other part is the non-self. But looking into what we call a self, we see only non-self elements. Like this flower, as a practitioner of mindfulness, you look deeply into this flower and you see that this flower is made only of non-flower elements. There's a cloud inside also. Because if there is no cloud, there's no rain and no flower can grow. So you don't see the form of a cloud, but the cloud is there. And that is the practice of what we call signlessness. You don't need a sign, an appearance, in order to see it. There is the sunshine inside. We know that if there is no sunshine, no flower can grow. There is the topsoil inside. Many things are inside. Light, minerals, the gardener. It seems that everything of the cosmos have come together in order to help produce this flower. If we have enough concentration, we will see that the whole cosmos is in the flower. The one is made by the all. And we can say that a flower is made only of non-flower elements. And if you return the cloud to the sky, if you return the light to the sun, the soil to the earth, there's no flower left. So it's very clear that a flower is made only of non-flower elements. So what we call me, myself, is like that too. We are also a flower. Each of us is a flower in the garden of humanity. And each flower is beautiful. But we have to look into ourselves and recognize the fact that we are made only of non-us elements. If we remove all the non-us elements, we cannot continue. We are made of parents, teachers, food, culture, and everything. And if we remove all of that, there is no us left. Therefore, the notion of self should be removed in order for us not to be caught in a notion that can create discrimination and fear and hate. breathing in and out is very pleasant. More pleasant than talking. When a young man looks into himself, he can see that he is made of non-self element. Suppose he looks into every cell of his body, he sees his father. His father is not only outside, his father is inside of him and fully present in every cell of his body. Suppose he tried to remove his father from him. There's no son left. If we remove the father, remove the mother, the grandfather, the grandmother, if we remove our education, our culture, the food we used to eat, and then there's no us left. So the young man can see that his father is in him. He is the continuation of his father. He is his father. It's like the tea is a continuation of the cloud. Suppose the tea hates the cloud. The tea says, I don't want to have anything to do with the cloud. That's nonsense. Nonsense. And yet there are young men who are so angry at their fathers. And they dare to say, I don't want to have anything to do with that person. Because they have not looked deeply. They do not see that they are the continuation of their father. They cannot remove their father from them. They are their father. So getting angry at one father is to get angry at yourself. So that is the insight you get from the practice of mindfulness, concentration. And if you have that insight, you are no longer angry at your father. You know that if your father suffers, you suffer. If you are happy, your father is happy also. No more discrimination between father and son. Because father is made of non-father elements, and son is made of non-son elements. Everything is like that. So the first notion that the Diamond Sutra advises us to remove is the notion of self. That is separation, that is discrimination. And if you can see in the light of interbeing, you are in me and I am in you. You got the insight. And anger and the willingness to punish is no longer there. So removing the notion of self is the basic action for peace. If the Palestinians look deeply, they see that the suffering of the Israelis are their suffering. And the happiness is also the happiness of the Israelis. So if they recognize that they are that their happiness and suffering depend on each other, and then they will release their anger, their fear, the discrimination, and they can make peace easily. If the Hindu and the Muslim, they look deeply and they see them in each other, and then there's no conflict, no war. So the removal of the notion of self is very crucial for peace. And if we can do that, we can be free from any discrimination, separation, fear, hate, anger, and violence. The second notion that the Diamond Sutra advises us to remove is the notion of man, human. Because the man is made only of non-man element. And man, we know that is very young species on earth. We are made of minerals, vegetals, and animals. Humans have human ancestors. But we do have animal ancestors. And we have vegetal ancestors. And we have mineral ancestors. And they are still in us. We are the continuation of our ancestors. We still carry the minerals with us. We still carry the vegetal and the animal with us. And man is made only of non-man elements. And if you have that insight, you will protect the ecosystem. You will not destroy this planet. And that is why the Diamond Sutra can be seen as the most ancient text on the teaching of deep ecology. In order to protect man, you have to protect minerals, vegetables, and animals. So the first notion we have to remove is the notion of self. Atma, self. The second notion we have to remove is the notion of man, Purusha. Self is made only of non-self element. Humans are made only of non-human elements. And with mindfulness and concentration, we can discover the truth of no self, the truth of interbeing. And the third notion that the Diamond Sutra advises us to remove is the notion of living beings. We know that living beings sattvas, atma, purusha, sattvas. Is the expression Mahasattva, great being, Mahasattva, Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, Bodhat, Mahatat. Bodhisattva, it means a being that is already enlightened. Body is enlightenment. And Mahasattva is a great being. But when the word sattva does is not combined, but got combined by maha or body. So we are not bodhisattvas, we are not Buddhas. So there is a discrimination between being and Buddhas. So there is a discrimination between us, in us about we and the Buddhas. And that is why there is a teaching that if you want to look for a Buddha, you have to look into yourself, into a living being. When I was ordained as a novice monk at the age of 16, my teacher showed me how to bow to the Buddha. My child, before you bow to the Buddha, you have to meditate. And he gave me a short verse to memorize. Năng lễ sở lễ tánh không tịch, cảm ứng đạo giáo đang từ nghỉ. The one who bows and the one who is bowed to, the nature of both are empty, is empty. It means that I am made of non-self element. I am empty of a separate self. And you, the Buddha, you are also made of non-you elements. I am made of non-me element, and you, the Buddha, you are also made of non-you element. It means that you are in me, I am in you. And there is a discrimination between a Buddha and a living being. And if you do not get that kind of insight, communication, communion is impossible. You have to see the relationship between you and the Buddha. You must see that the Buddha is made only of non-Buddha elements. And you must see that you are made of non-you elements. It means that you are in the Buddha and the Buddha in you. And before that, you should not bow because it does not help. Because there is a separation. You think that the Buddha is another reality, another entity. And I am another entity. There's a line of separation. So no communication is possible. The one who bows and the one who is bowed to, the nature of both are empty, is empty. And that is why communication can be very deep, perfect. So there is a discrimination between Buddha, the enlightened one, and living beings that who are us. There is a discrimination between the creator and the creature, and that does not help with communion, real communion. You have to see God in yourself, and you have to see you in God in order for true communication be possible. In Buddhism, it's very easy to say that the Buddha is made only of non-Buddha elements. The Buddha will not be offended. Because that is what he teaches. The living being is made of non-living being elements. The Buddha is made only of non-Buddha elements. And that is the insight. No discrimination. Suppose you grow lotus flowers. And every one of us who know how to grow lotus flowers, we know that lotus is made only of non-lotus elements. And among the non-lotus elements, there is the mud. The mud does not smell very, very good. The mud is not immaculate, not very clean. But without mud, you can never grow lotus flower. So when you look into a lotus flower, and if you have not seen the mud in it, you have not seen the lotus flower. If you look into the tea, and you have not seen the cloud in it, you have not seen the tea. So meditation helps us to see the things that other people cannot see. So looking into a Buddha, what do you see? You see a lot of afflictions, sadness, despair that have been transformed. It's like looking into a lotus flower, you see the mud and all these kind of things. So a Buddha is made of non-Buddha elements. That person, before he became a Buddha, or she became a Buddha, she suffered of anger, fear, hatred, wrong perceptions. And because she knew how to practice mindfulness, concentration, she got the insight and she is free. She became a Buddha. So looking into a Buddha, you see non-Buddha elements. And if you do not see non-Buddha elements in the Buddha, you have not seen the Buddha. Don't imagine that the Buddha is an entity that is completely separated from we human beings. The safest place to look for a Buddha is in yourself. It is with the mud that you can grow lotus flower. It is with the suffering, the afflictions, the fear, the anger, that you can make the compost in order to nourish the flower of Buddhahood in ourselves. And that is why the notion of living being as something separated from a Mahasattva, a Bodhisattva, a Buddha, that distinction between you and the Buddha should be removed. And if you come from a Christian background, you are invited to meditate the same between creator and creature. And if you think that these two, creator and creature, are two distinctive entities separated from each other, you have not seen, you have not understood. You are still caught in the dualistic way of thinking. Outside of creature, you cannot see the creator. This morning, our practice is to touch the kingdom of God in every step, with every step. And if you touch the kingdom of God deeply, you touch God. God cannot be away other than the kingdom, His kingdom. The kingdom of God is God. And if you touch the kingdom of God, you touch God. Look at this flower. With mindfulness and concentration, this is a wonder. And if you can touch this wonder, you know that she belongs to the kingdom of God. If that wonder does not belong to the kingdom of God, where should she belong to? And that is why when you get in touch with that wonder, you get in touch with the kingdom. And if you touch the kingdom, you touch God. Don't try to find God as some external reality. And that is why in Rinzai Lingji Zen tradition, we speak of Sinh Phạt Bất Nhị. The non-dualistic view about living being and the Buddha. This is the human being, the living being. And this is the Buddha. And when you look into the living being, you see the Buddha. When you look into the Buddha, you see the living beings. Because you are made of non-dual elements, and the Buddha is made of non-Buddha elements. And if you get inside, communication between you and the Buddha will be very deep. Otherwise, you are worshipping an idea that is not reality. So, living being, sattvas, and Buddha, bodhisattva, they are not two separate things. Not two. And that is why the Diamond Sutra advises us to remove the notion of living being. You are the Buddha. You have the Buddha nature. And if you practice mindfulness concentration, you can transform the afflictions. And the fourth the fourth notion. I think I need my cloud. That is the notion of lifespan. Thọ giá. Lifespan. Suppose we draw a line from left to right. Representing time. And suppose we pick up one point here and we call it B. And another point we call it D, representing birth and death. And usually we think that birth is the point where we start to exist, to be. So from the segment from birth, from B on, is being. Before we are born, we did not exist. So the segment ended with B, representing non-being. And when we come to D, I'm very afraid of coming to this point. It's not pleasant to think of D. And because we are afraid because of the notion, if you can remove it, you are not longer afraid of D. You are saved by right understanding, not by a God, but by right understanding, by getting out of wrong thinking. So we believe that from the point D on, we pass into the realm of non-being again. And we believe that to be born means from the realm of non-being, you pass into the realm of being. And to die means from the realm of being, you pass again into the realm of non-being. To die means from someone, you suddenly become no one. And you are caught in the notion of birth and death. You are caught in the notion of being and non-being. And many of us are caught in the notion of being and non-being. In the religious circles and also in the scientific circles. Because in the religious circle, we speak of creation, the beginning of the cosmos, the beginning of the universe. The universe, the cosmos, did not exist. It belonged to the realm of non-being. And at the time of creation, well, we have the existence of the cosmos. So we believe in the notion of non-being and being. Many of us believe that the cosmos have come from the realm of non-being into being. And that is how we understand creation, the beginning of the cosmos. And not only the people, the believers, believe so, but the scientists, they believe also. They believe that the cosmos has a beginning. And they are speaking about how the cosmos has come to be. That is why they have invented theories like the Big Bang. It means before that, there's no cosmos, there's no universe. The Big Bang and then the Big Crunch later on. And that is why we need the practice of mindfulness concentration in order to get the insight that liberates us from these notions, the notion of birth and death, the notion of being and non-being. A well-known theologian described God as the ground of being. I think his name is Paul Tillich. God is the ground of being. But if God is the ground of being, who will be the ground of non-being? You cannot conceive God in terms of being and non-being. God, the ultimate must transcend both notions. So to describe God in terms of being is to reduce God to something much less than God. And that is why reality, according to right view or right thinking, is free of the notion of being and non-being. In order to help liberate us from the notion of being, the Buddha has invented a notion. And he said that we have to be careful to use this notion, the notion of interbeing. Co-being. Suppose you look at this marker. We recognize the left and the right. And we know that wherever there is the right, there is the left. The right cannot be by itself alone. It has to go be, interbe with the left, with the right. And the same thing is true with the above and the below. If there is the above, there must be the below. And many of us try to eliminate one of the two, like life and death. We only want to keep life. We want to ban death. But how could life be possible without death? And that is very foundation of life. Life is foundation of death. And they go always together. And do not believe that death is something that waits for us down the road. No. Because life is here, death is also here at the same time. They always go together. You cannot say that now is birth, now is life, and death is for later. That's not right thinking. And science can help us understand that also. We know that at every moment, many cells die in our body, right? And many cells are born, new cells are born. So many cells are dying in 1 second. And we are too busy to organize funerals for them. We have to organize thousands and thousands of funerals because every moment many cells die. And at every moment many new cells are born. And again, we don't have the time to organize happy birthday celebration for them. So birth and death is something that happens in the here and the now, in every moment, in every second, in every millisecond. Why are we afraid of death? We are experiencing death in every moment. Because where there is life, there is death. Where there is left, there is a right. If politically you are on the left, don't try to eliminate the right. If the right is not there, you are not there either. So the left cannot be by itself alone, it has to interbe with the right. The same is true with happiness and suffering. Many of us think that happiness alone is enough. We don't need suffering, but suffering is something that helps create happiness. And we know very well that if we look deeply into suffering, our own suffering, and the suffering of the other person, we will come to understand that the nature, the root of that suffering. And understanding suffering gives rise to compassion and love. And understanding and love is the foundation of happiness. If you do not have any amount of understanding and compassion, you are not a happy person. A person who has no love, no compassion in him or her can never relate to another human being. And compassion, love, is born from understanding. If you understand your own suffering, and if you understand her suffering, his suffering, and then love and compassion will be possible. So it is the mud that helps produce the lotus. It is the suffering that helps produce the flower of happiness. So let us not discriminate against the suffering. Let us learn how to make good use of the suffering in order to create happiness. Let us learn how to make good use of the mud in order to produce lotus flowers. If you are a good organic gardener, you never want to throw away the garbage, because you know how to make good use of the garbage to make compost and nourish flowers and vegetables. Looking into a flower, you see a piece of garbage of the future. And looking into a piece of garbage, you can see vegetable, cucumber, tomatoes in it. The only thing is that you should know how to handle the garbage in order to nourish the flowers. And practitioners, they are not afraid of suffering, because they know how to make good use of the suffering, the mud of suffering, in order to produce the flower, the lotus of happiness. So if we believe that our life begins here at the point B and go end at D, we are caught in the fourth notion, lifespan. But already we have looked deeply into the nature of a cloud. We know that the moment when a cloud appears as a cloud, she did not belong to the realm of non-being. She was the water vapor. She was the water in the ocean. She has not come from the realm of non-being. Non-being is only an idea. Also, being is only an idea. And the notion of being and non-being, they are born together. And they are just notion. So to believe that you are born at this point, and you will die at this point, and after that, nothing else and nothing remains, you are caught in a notion of lifespan. It is impossible for you to die. It is impossible for the cloud to pass into the realm of non-being. And that is why right view transcends the notion of being and non-being, birth and death. And that is why that insight can help produce right thinking, right speech, and right action. It has the power to heal and to nourish. And we know that the five mindfulness trainings, the new version of the five mindfulness trainings, is a very concrete description of the path proposed by the Buddha, the Eightfold Noble Path, beginning with right view and right thinking, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right efforts, diligence, mindfulness, concentration. Mindfulness and concentration bring right view. And with right view, you can generate right thinking, right speech, and right action. And it's possible to present the path in a non-religious, non-sectarian way, that people who do not call themselves Buddhists can apply. Because practicing according to the five mindfulness trainings, you remove all discrimination, fear, despair. Because you train yourself to transcend that kind of dualistic thinking, characterized by wrong view, wrong thinking, wrong speech. Because discrimination always creates separation and suffering. And when we look deeply, we get the insight that is free from discrimination, and peace becomes possible, love becomes possible. And that is why we hope that in the future, the teaching of the five mindfulness trainings, the teaching of mindfulness can be taught at school so that the young people can suffer less and create more harmony in their life, in the life of their family and their society. Some of the questions, right? We still have half an hour. Since we have been doing the economy, how do people apply mindfulness when they are fearful about financial security or the future when they are out of work? In other words, in time of crisis like this, how can mindfulness help? The Buddha spoke about the second arrow. Suppose someone is hit by an arrow. There is pain. There is a painful feeling. But if a few minutes later, a second arrow comes and strike that person exactly at the same spot, the pain will not only be double. The pain can be 100 times more intense. And we have to handle the situation in such a way that prevent the second arrow to come. When you have some pain in your body, just breathe in and recognize the pain, and do not exaggerate. If you exaggerate, and if you revolt against that, if you get angry, if you get despair, well, the pain will be many times more intensive. Mindfulness help us to recognize the suffering and the pain as it is, and not to exaggerate, not to magnify it by fear, anger, despair. If you allow anger, fear, despair to come, you suffer much more. And that is the second arrow. So in a time of economic crisis, we just practice mindful breathing and recognize it as it is, and do not allow fear, anger, despair to come. We will suffer more. That is the first thing that we can do in order to suffer less. And if we practice mindfulness, we come home to the here and the now, and we might recognize that there are still many conditions that of happiness that are still there. We can continue to be happy. Think of people who live in a situation of war. And the situation of pollution. The effect, suffering from the effect of the tsunami, the atomic fallout, the lack of democracy, social injustice, social oppression. There are many spots like that in the world, and people suffer very much of these things. And going home to the here and the now with the practice of mindfulness, we can see that we still have a lot of conditions of happiness available. It is not too difficult for us to survive a difficult financial time. And there are those of us who have the capacity to live more simply. We don't need to live in a house like that. We can live in a smaller house. We can have a meager salary, and yet we can continue to be happy. If you look at the monks who live here, none of them has a bank account. No one has a private car, a private telephone. And yet they laugh all day, all day long. They have a brotherhood, sisterhood. They have a chance to organize days of mindfulness and retreats of mindfulness and help people to suffer less. They don't have a private home. They live together as a community. Then why are we so afraid? We can adapt ourselves in this new situation. We have our talent, we have our love, we have our mindfulness. There's no reason why we have to worry too much about that. We have the capacity to live simply, much more simply. Don't allow fear to come as the second arrow, fear and anger and despair. And if you are free from fear, anger, and despair, you are lucid. And with your lucidity and joy, you can recreate a new situation, a better situation for the economy. So the practice of mindfulness is very helpful. It helps us not to suffer too much. It helps us to be lucid in order to change the situation. If you allow the anger, fear, and despair to overwhelm us, the situation will get worse. So many people suffer, yet will not even take one step to help themselves, even though they say they want to. They appear a bit lost. To the person who has never heard of mindfulness, what is the one thing you would say to them, the one first step a first timer can take to bring the start of mindfulness into their life? We need a friend who is a practitioner. We need a community of practitioners. Because a true practitioner always radiates joy and love. Because she practices mindfulness, that is why she knows how to go home to the here and the now and enjoy the conditions of happiness she is having in the here and the now. She doesn't complain, she is not angry, so to be close to a person like that, you enjoy his or her presence. And you can be supported by that person to begin your practice. You can enjoy breathing in and breathing out. When there is a problem, the practice of mindful breathing can help you handle the difficulty. But at the time where there is no difficulty, you can enjoy the practice of mindful breathing, the practice of mindful walking to nourish yourself, to heal yourself. So walking, stopping the thinking, walking, touching the wonders of life in yourself, around you, can be very healing, can be very nourishing. And with a friend who is a practitioner, you are encouraged, you are inspired to do like him or her. So the presence of a friend who is a practitioner may be the first step. As a practitioner, we always try to set up a sangha, a community of practice in our neighborhood, so that we can come together every week to spend time together for one day to practice together. Because when you come together as a group, the energy of mindfulness and joy and peace will be collective and is very nourishing. So every good practitioner always try to set up a group of practitioners, and that is called a sangha. So what we recommend is that the person get in touch with a practitioner and belong to a sangha where she can begin and nourish and maintain her practice of mindfulness. There are many wars in the world, and more all the time. When I once asked what we can each do about this, you said, peace in yourself, peace in the world. Can you explain that? We know that peace should begin with yourself. If you allow yourself to be carried away by despair, anger, fear, you cannot do anything for peace. That is why the practice of mindfulness helps you to remain calm, lives it, not to be carried away by emotions like fear, anger, and despair. If you allow yourself to be carried away like that, you make the situation worse. You cannot serve peace. So that is why the practice of mindful breathing, mindful walking, can nourish you and prevent you to not to become a victim of the collective energy of fear, anger, and despair. It's very crucial. And I, my friends, have had that experience in the situation of war in Vietnam. There were moments when we were about to be carried away by despair. I remember one day, several young people came and sit with me and said, "Thầy, do you think that the world will end someday?" Because it had been dragging on for decades, and we did not see any light, any end of the tunnel. So it's very easy to be victim of despair. It's a very difficult moment. So I remember that day I practiced mindful breathing, and then I will look at them. I look at them and say, "My dear friends," they were young students. The Buddha said, "Everything is impermanent. The war is impermanent also. It must end one day." So we try to, in a situation of war in Vietnam, we try to rely on people to work for peace. But it's very difficult. It was a very difficult thing to do in Vietnam. Because in a situation of war like that, you have to belong to one of the warring parties. And you'll be protected by that warring party. At least you are attacked by the other party, but at least you are protected by one warring party. But you are a peace worker. You cannot align yourself with one warring party. If you do, you participate in a war. So not to participate in one of the two warring parties, you become vulnerable for both. And we were in that situation. And many of our workers, social workers and peace workers, were maimed, killed, eliminated. And that is why there were those of us who tried to immolate ourselves by fire in order to call for the attention of the world, call for help to end the war in Vietnam. And finally, my friends sent me outside of the country in order to call for help. Because in the country, you have no right to speak about peace and reconciliation. You are supposed to say that you will fight to the end. The other side is evil. We are caught in a machine of war, the communist and the anti-communist. Not only we use ideologies from the outside, but we use the weapons from the outside to kill ourselves. So we started a campaign, stop the war, stop brothers, stop killing each other. And to call the other side brothers is very dangerous. They are not your brothers. They are your enemies. You have to kill them. So you have no radio, no newspaper, nothing to voice your concern. You are caught. That is why sometimes you have to burn yourself alive in order to catch the attention of the world out of love. And we decided to send someone outside in order to call for the end of the atrocities. And I intended to come to the West only for 3 months. After that, I have to go home and continue my work there. But they did not allow me to go home, and I had to spend 39 years in exile. And yet, because of these efforts, the peace movement continued. to grow in Vietnam and to grow in the West. And the collective consciousness about war and the collective desire to end the war is very crucial. But there are those of us who are angry after after a period of working for peace. So in the peace movement, there were anger, frustration. And the peace movement was not very peaceful. So I had to deal with that. We need them, but we need to help them not to be angry in their effort to end the war. So we try to offer the practice of peace. Being peace is the ground for doing peace. If you are not peaceful, you cannot serve peace. And in order to be peaceful, you should learn how to breathe, how to walk, how to handle your emotion like anger and despair. And we try to help bring that kind of practice of peace into the peace movement. It's not easy. We have learned a lot from that. So the practice of mindfulness and concentration keep you sane and help you to continue. Otherwise, you will be lost in despair. Practice of mindfulness and concentration help you to see the roots of the war. Fear, violence, anger, discrimination. All these come from wrong perception, wrong views. They do not have right view. They consider their brother as enemy. And because of wrong perceptions, they think that the other side is trying to kill them, to destroy them as a religion, as a nation, as a country, like the terrorist. The terrorist has a lot of anger, the willingness to punish, hate, because in them there is the wrong perception that there are nations, there are people who are trying to destroy them as a religion, as a way of life, as a culture, as a nation. Maybe there is some discrimination, some anger on our part that have given them that notion. That wrong perceptions. So that is why after September 11th, in a talk offered in Berkeley for 4,000 people, I said, "Dear friends, dear brothers, let us breathe in mindfully and calm ourselves down." The terrorist may have a wrong idea, may have got the wrong idea that you want to destroy them. You want to destroy them as a race, as a nation, as a culture, as a religion. They may got that wrong perception from somewhere. And we may have said something. We might have done something that gave them the impression that we want to destroy them. So the enemy is not them. The enemy is the wrong perceptions in them. And only with with deep listening, the practice of deep listening and loving speech, that you can help people to remove their wrong perceptions. And when the wrong perceptions are removed, there is no longer fear, anger, and violence. And you cannot remove wrong perceptions with the bombs and with the guns. You have to use compassionate listening and loving speech. You have to say something like, "Dear friends over there, you might have thought that we want to destroy you as a religion, as a culture, as a race, as a nation, but we do not have that intention. We may have said something or done something that make you believe that, but it's not our intention to destroy you as a religion, as a culture, as a race. So please tell us what we have done wrong so that we will understand and we refrain from saying or doing things that can give you the impression that we want to harm you. And if we can listen as a nation, honestly, they will be able to tell us. And we will try to help remove the wrong perceptions in them. And the roots of terrorism can only be removed with that kind of practice, and not with the guns." And only 3 days after the event, September 11th, we already proposed that kind of practice. So in a situation of war, there must be wrong perceptions on both sides, warring parties. And that is why there should be people who try to make both warring parties understand and see the suffering on not only on their side, but on the other side. And there must be peacemakers. And peacemakers are those who have the capacity to get in touch with both warring parties, who have the capacity to listen with compassion and to use loving speech in order to help remove wrong perceptions on this side and on the other side. You cannot ally yourself with one side in order to hope for peace. And that is what we have tried to do in the country and outside the country to promote reconciliation and peace. And when you are lucid, you have compassion in yourself. You are no longer victims of your wrong perceptions, and you know exactly what to do and what not to do in order to make the situation worse, in order to help create and rely people on the side of peacemaking. And those of us who have been in the peace movement, many of us have been killed, maimed, and we have learned a lot from that. The practice of mindfulness is very crucial in order to survive and to help remove wrong perceptions. People tend to talk of monks and mindfulness in a very serious tones, but I know you have a good sense of humor, and you and other monks are happy. I think, well, you know that the monks and the nuns here, they play volleyball, basketball, they climb up the mountains. They're having a good time practicing mindfulness. This morning, a number of us prepare the Dhamma hall, and a number of us climb to the mountain and do sitting meditation up there. It's so beautiful. If you have not come up there, you have not seen Deer Park Monastery. So in a retreat about 10 days ago, we had the chance to bring all the retreatants to the top of the mountains for sitting meditation and mindful lunch up there. It's so beautiful, so happy, and the collective energy is very joyful. Although it's silent, but that is a kind of silence that nourishes joy and happiness. And living together as a community, we have the capacity to generate that kind of collective energy of joy and brotherhood. And we can generate feelings of joy and happiness with the practice of mindfulness. In fact, mindfulness, the practice of mindfulness of breathing and walking, help us to come home to the here and the now. And when we are established in the here and the now, we recognize there's so many conditions of happiness available. And joy, happiness become possible at any time when mindfulness is there. And we can say that mindfulness is a source of joy, a source of happiness. Many of us think that happiness is made of power, fame, sex, wealth. But many people running after these objects suffer very deeply. And those of us who practice mindfulness and concentration, we know that every moment can be a happy moment. Because a moment of happiness is a moment when you are truly in the here and the now, and you notice that so many wonders are in you and around you, and you can be happy right here and right now. And that is the teaching of the Buddha. It is possible to be happy and joyful in the here and the now. Every in-breath, every step can help you touch the wonders of life. Recognize that you are luckier than so many people. And if you are happy, you have an opportunity to help other people.